Imagine waking up one day and realizing that, well, 20,000 students have seemingly just vanished from your city's school system, like in just 2 years.
Right, just gone.
Yeah, they didn't evaporate, they weren't abducted, they just quietly moved across these totally invisible borders.
Welcome to today's deep dive. Today, we are looking at a July 2026 analytical report. It is published by Memphis TV and the Memphis Times, and it is called White Memphis: History, Class, Space, Power, and Change.
It is a really fascinating document.
It is. And the mission here today for you listening is to basically deconstruct this idea of a demographic monolith. We are going to explore what happens when a city's historical majority population ostensibly disappears from the city limits.
And, you know, how centuries of history and class and geography interact to actually make that happen.
Exactly. Okay. Let's unpack this. Because when you look at Memphis today, it's known as a majority black central city. But the white population didn't just vanish. They just redrew the map.
Yeah, the first thing this report does is absolutely kill the idea that white Memphis is just one big uniform monolith.
Right.
It treats this population as an incredibly diverse, historically constructed social group. It throws out any notion of a biological or unified entity.
Because it's not just one group of people who all think and act the same.
No, not at all. You are actually looking at a deeply fractured group of people. They are separated by class, ancestry, religion, geography. And if we want to understand the modern reality of any major city, you have to look at how these distinct groups were assembled and layered.
And ultimately separated over time, right. But those broad demographic strokes, they don't just happen by accident.
Definitely not.
To build a map that's segregated, you need to first clarify who and where you're actually talking about, which means we need to get our hands dirty with the data.
I love getting into the data.
I know you do. Think of census data like a camera lens. If you zoom in tight on the city limits of Memphis, it looks like one very specific picture. But if you swap to a wide-angle lens and capture the entirety of Shelby County, the whole composition just completely changes.
Right, so let's actually look through that wide-angle lens using the 2020 to 2024 census quick facts. But we are going to space the numbers out because raw data can get really overwhelming fast.
Oh, yeah, totally. Pace yourself.
So if you look at people who identify as white alone inside the Memphis city limits, it is about 23.8% of the population, just under a quarter.
Okay, so that is the tight lens.
Exactly. But when you zoom out to include all of Shelby County, that number suddenly jumps to 40%. But, and this is crucial, the data requires a scalpel here.
A scalpel.
Yeah, because when you filter specifically for non-Hispanic white, the numbers shift again. Inside the city limits, it drops to roughly 22.4%. And in the wider county, it sits at about 32.2%.
Okay, let me pause you right there. Because to someone just glancing at a spreadsheet distinguishing between white alone and non-Hispanic white sounds, I mean, like a wildly nerdy technical footnote for statisticians.
It really does sound like that.
Right. So if we are trying to understand the big picture of a city, does that granular distinction actually matter to the story?
Oh, absolutely. What's fascinating here is that it completely rewrites the story of assimilation and identity in America.
Really? How so?
Well, the broader census category of white alone includes people who also identify as Hispanic or Latino. When you exclude Hispanic origin from that data set, you get a much cleaner measure for long-run historical comparison.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, it lets you trace the traditional non-Hispanic white population back through the 20th century. And it reveals a stunning contrast when you compare it regionally.
Like comparing it to other cities in the South.
Exactly. Memphis has that 22.4% non-Hispanic white core. But you drive a few hours to Nashville, and their core sits at nearly 52.6%.
Wait, really? Why is Nashville so drastically different? Is it just, I don't know, a totally different culture?
It actually comes down to invisible borders and how we measure them. Nashville operates under a consolidated government.
Meaning the city and the county are the same thing.
Right. Back in the 1960s, Nashville essentially merged its city and county governments into one massive entity. So when Nashville's upwardly mobile populations moved to the suburbs, they were still technically inside Nashville.
Oh, wow. So they never left the data pool.
Precisely. Memphis didn't do that. In Memphis, crossing the city limit meant you were in a different jurisdiction entirely. So the demographic flight wasn't captured in the same bucket.
Which means we aren't just looking at people moving that. we're looking at people crossing jurisdictional lines.
Yes, exactly.
But those wide-angle numbers, they don't just happen organically. How did the population get so geographically spread out in Memphis specifically?
You really have to trace the historical forces that pushed and pulled residents outward.
And according to the report, that story doesn't start in the suburbs. It starts way back at the city's founding in 1819.
Way back.
Right, because the early white elite in Memphis wasn't just this agrarian, plantation-owning class that you might stereotypically picture when you think of the Old South.
No, they were highly commercial.
They were financial. They were basically the Wall Street of the river, building vast wealth on cotton capitalism, river commerce on the Mississippi, and, of course, the brutal exploitation of enslaved labor.
They were an urban commercial elite, first and foremost. But that power structure, it was not unchallenged.
Right, after the Civil War.
Yes. To understand the modern map, you really have to look at the 1866 Memphis massacre immediately following the war.
Which the report highlights as a huge turning point.
It was. This wasn't just a random riot. It was a calculated, horrific, violent restoration of white political power.
Because white civilians and police attacked black residents, right?
Yes. They burned homes. They destroyed schools. It was a brutal reassertion of control after emancipation. And that violent control didn't just disappear over time.
It just formalized.
Exactly. It evolved into Jim Crow.
And we usually think of Jim Crow as just, you know, a set of segregation laws on a book somewhere, like separate water fountains, separate seating areas, that sort of thing.
Right, the social stuff.
But the report argues it was way more systemic than that.
Oh, much more. Jim Crow was a comprehensive metropolitan allocation system.
Meaning it was moving money around.
Exactly. It wasn't just about keeping people apart socially. It was a massive financial engine. It actively directed public investments, parks, sanitation, and crucial mortgage credit directly into white districts.
Wow.
Yeah, while simultaneously and systematically confining black mobility.
So let's connect those historical dominoes for a second. So what does this all mean?
It means generational equity.
Right, because if a bank, backed by government policy, denies a mortgage to a black neighborhood in 1930, that directly funds the wealth accumulation of a white neighborhood by 1970.
You nailed it. The city essentially engineered its own development to heavily favor one group's ability to build generational equity.
And that generational equity became the fuel for what happened next.
The 1970s.
Yes, the pivotal decade. The courts ordered busing to integrate Memphis City schools in 1972 and 1973. And this is where that vanished student statistic from the intro comes from.
It is wild to think about. Roughly 20,000 white students disappeared from the public school system during that very short transition.
Because they had the accumulated wealth to just simply opt out.
Right. They enrolled in private schools, or their families just picked up and moved entirely.
And this coincided directly with massive physical infrastructure changes too, right?
Yes. You have the construction of the I-240 highway loop, and at the same time, massive federal underwriting for suburban mortgages.
It's like the city built an escape hatch at the exact moment a demographic panic was setting in.
An escape hatch funded by federal dollars, specifically available to those who had the stable incomes to qualify for those new suburban mortgages.
So if you put those two things together, the highway system and the busing fears, it basically acted like a giant centrifuge.
A centrifuge, yeah.
Just violently spinning wealth and upwardly mobile populations outward into the eastern suburbs.
Yeah.
And leaving those without the means to move behind in these rapidly deindustrializing urban zones.
The centrifuge is the perfect way to look at it, because it highlights the actual mechanism of the shift. School choice effectively became a housing choice.
Because you moved to the district you want.
Right. Families treated suburban addresses and private schools as insurance policies against integration and against falling property values.
Though nobody wants to admit that.
Exactly. Nobody wants to admit they're buying a zip code just to avoid integration.
Yeah.
So they say, oh, it's about tree-lined streets or better amenities.
Instead of parks.
Right. But here is the compounding tragedy of that centrifuge. Every time a family hit the exit, it reduced the city's tax base.
Draining the pool.
It drained financial resources from the urban core. That degraded the perceived quality of the city system, which then triggered more families to leave. It was just this self-fulfilling cycle of capital flight.
And that centrifuge didn't just move people physically. It created entirely new institutional borders to legally protect that outward movement.
School border wars.
Yes. Which brings us to this modern phenomenon the report covers. Fast forward to 2011. Memphis voters surrendered the city school charter.
Essentially saying they just couldn't fund it alone anymore.
Right. That forced a brief, highly contentious city-county school merger in 2013. But it only lasted a year.
Just 1 year.
Because immediately in 2014, six suburban municipal districts literally seceded to form their own independent school systems.
Places like Bartlett, Collierville, Germantown.
They just left. And they waved the banner of local control and educational accountability.
Of course.
But researchers in the report note that the practical, measurable effect was the rigid reproduction of deep race and class boundaries.
It allowed wealthier, predominantly white municipalities to govern and fund their schools completely separately from the majority black county system.
You sever the tax base, you sever the shared destiny.
And you see the glaring result in the extreme segregation at the ZIP code level today.
The numbers on that are staggering, honestly. The report points out that Eastern ZIP codes out in those suburban areas like 38139 are over 86% white.
Wow.
Meanwhile, if you look at some North and South Memphis ZIP codes, the white population sits below 3%.
It is a massive disparity.
So wait, here's where it gets really interesting. Let me play devil's advocate here.
Okay, go for it.
Are you telling me that a suburban zoning board rejecting a new high-density apartment complex or a town drawing a new school district line is essentially just doing the exact same work that explicit Jim Crow segregation laws used to do, just with, like, better PR?
That is the core synthesis of this entire section of the report.
Really?
Yes. The old explicit laws are gone, but they have been replaced by invisible fences.
Invisible fences?
Things like low-density zoning, prohibitive entry costs for housing, and strict municipal boundaries act as absolute barriers.
Because you literally can't afford to get in.
Exactly. They preserve exclusivity. The mechanism is entirely economic now. They take things like high school test scores, perceived neighborhood safety, and even low flood risk, and they bake the value of those things right into the premium cost of buying a house there.
So you're buying the test scores when you buy the house.
Yes. They manage to completely sort the population by race and wealth, without anyone ever having to utter a single explicit racial syllable.
It's basically segregation by spreadsheet.
That's exactly what it is.
But, you know, if we only talk about suburban wealth, Germantown mansions, high-value real estate, it's incredibly easy to fall into the trap of assuming all white Memphians are affluent.
Which is completely false.
Right. The report shatters this assumption entirely. We have to talk about the myth of the monolith, because the reality on the ground is drastically different for a huge portion of this population.
The internal class divide is massive, and it is completely obscured by that aggregate data we talked about earlier.
So let's break it down.
Let's look at the income gap. The white median household income in the county overall was about $90,183.
Okay.
For comparison, the black household median income was $48,205.
That's a huge gap.
But now, if you zoom in on an exclusive suburb like Germantown, the median income rockets up to nearly $150,000.
Right. But then you look inside the city limits, and the white poverty rate is 8.9%.
Almost 9%, yeah.
You have working class and poor white populations facing devastating deindustrialization, disability, and severe addiction issues.
The report specifically notes that amphetamine-related hospitalizations are notably high among white Tennesseans.
Which is heartbreaking. Okay. And you also have the massive logistics industry in Memphis. It's a huge hub.
Massive. It employs roughly 17.1% of the entire metro area.
And you have white workers at every single level of that industry.
From top to bottom.
You have the executive suites of FedEx, sure. But you also have people working grueling, physically punishing hourly shifts on the warehouse floors. I mean, when people casually throw around the phrase white privilege, they usually picture that $150,000 Germantown wealth.
Usually, yes.
So how does a sociology report reconcile this concept of structural privilege with the reality of severe working class vulnerability, addiction, and poverty?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it does it by distinguishing between probability and scale.
Probability and scale.
The report offers this crucial dual conclusion. Whiteness changes the probability of access to resources, but class changes the scale of those resources.
Okay, probability versus scale. Walk me through how that actually plays out in someone's daily life.
So structural advantage exists in the aggregate probabilities. A working class white resident might statistically benefit from not facing historical housing discrimination.
Like the redlining we talked about.
Right. Or they might have easier access to certain informal word-of-mouth job networks. That is the probability.
Oh, okay, I follow.
But scale is about raw capital. A deteriorating inherited house in a weak real estate market is not the same thing as liquid wealth.
It's equity, but you can't use it.
Exactly. If you are poor, you cannot draw on the buffers of private school tuition, a family trust fund, or a corporate network. You might share a racial demographic box on a census form with a wealthy logistics executive in Collierville, but you occupy a completely different economic universe.
And because the economic realities of these residents are so vastly different, it naturally fractures their politics and their culture.
It has to.
You can't have a monolith in your bank account and expect one at the ballot box.
Definitely not.
Let's look at the 2024 election data. Shelby County as a whole is heavily Democratic. The Democratic ticket took 61.8% of the vote.
A clear majority.
But the Republican ticket still pulled 36.4%. And the internal geography of that 36% is deeply polarized.
It is a profound internal fracture. The Republican base in the county is heavily concentrated among those suburban, affluent, and evangelical voters we were just talking about. Meanwhile, if you look at Midtown and the urban core of Memphis, you find younger, secular residents, LGBTQ voters, and urban professionals who strongly lean Democratic.
And just to be super clear with you listening, we are being strictly neutral here.
Yes, absolutely.
The researchers aren't making moral judgments. They aren't claiming that a vote for a specific party equals personal racial animus. They are strictly looking at the math.
Just the math.
They are mapping how geography, religion, and class dictate voting habits. Nothing more.
Right. And that internal divide, it spills over into the culture too.
Oh, for sure. Memphis has this incredible, globally recognized music history. Blues, soul, rockabilly at Sun Studio, Stax Records.
It was famously biracial.
It was, but the report points out it was also structurally unequal. You had intense, beautiful artistic collaboration on the studio floor, but often vastly unequal contracts benefiting white entrepreneurs in the back office.
The business side was very different.
Very. And today you see these massive generational divides over things like Confederate monuments and what even constitutes Southern identity.
Which is a huge debate right now.
Some older suburban residents view monument removal as an attack on heritage, while younger urban residents see it as a necessary step toward building a multiracial civic memory.
Which brings up a really fascinating tension.
So if demographics alone don't guarantee voting blocks anymore, I mean, if being a white Memphian doesn't tell you how someone will vote, what actually drives the political machine?
This raises an important question, right? Because it's property and borders.
Property.
The data suggests the old, simple white versus black binary is fading as the primary explanatory tool.
It's not enough anymore.
No. Politics in this region, and frankly in most American regions, are now organized fiercely around property values, taxation, education, and municipal boundaries.
Follow the money.
Exactly. It is a fight over who controls the tax base, who dictates zoning laws, and who funds the schools. The fracture is often between those who want to invest in a dense, diverse urban core and those who want to fiercely protect suburban institutional autonomy.
Which brings us to the future, because those invisible fences are about to be tested.
Big time.
The report outlines four major forces shaping the future of this demographic. First, continued suburban migration, meaning the central city's share of this population will likely keep falling.
Right. The outward push continues.
Second, a selective urban core return by young professionals. Not a mass migration, but very targeted, specific gentrification.
A small trickle back in.
Exactly. Third, a transition into a truly multiracial region with rapidly growing Hispanic and Asian populations, entirely diluting that old black-white binary.
Changing the math completely.
And fourth, massive regional economic restructuring, particularly automation in that huge logistics sector we talked about.
That is a huge one.
If robots take over the warehouse floor, that working class vulnerability we mentioned is going to skyrocket.
Those four forces are going to fundamentally redefine the landscape over the next decade. And here's why you, the listener, should care about this, even if you have never set foot in Tennessee.
Right. Why does this matter to someone in Ohio or Oregon?
Because Memphis is a masterclass in how any American metropolitan area functions. Understanding the historical centrifuge and the invisible fences of this specific city trains you to look past the surface-level demographics of your own hometown.
It trains you to see the hidden machinery.
Exactly. The next time you look at a bizarrely drawn school district boundary or a contentious zoning board meeting over an apartment complex or a highway overpass that neatly divides two neighborhoods, you won't just see infrastructure anymore.
No.
You will see class, space, and institutional power made physically visible.
You'll see the invisible fences doing their job.
Perfectly said.
The report ultimately notes that future influence in this region will rely heavily on property ownership, legacy institutions, and home equity, rather than just sheer population size.
It's all about the assets now.
But here is something to mull over that builds on the report's mention of how suburban housing bakes in things like flood risk and asset price risk.
Okay, lay it on me.
We have talked this whole time about how a giant historical centrifuge spun wealth outward, locking it up behind the invisible fences of suburban real estate.
Right, the safety of the suburbs.
The entire power structure is tied to property values. But what happens to that regional balance of power if environmental shifts, extreme weather, or massive municipal infrastructure failures suddenly make those highly valued suburban properties completely uninsurable?
Oh, wow.
Or uninhabitable. If your entire political and economic power is built on the sanctuary of suburban home equity, what happens when the sanctuary floods?
It completely upends the board. I mean, the wealth is tied to the land, and the land is never as permanent or as safe as we want to believe.
Something to think about the next time you look at a map or your mortgage statement. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.